Welcome to the Catholic Book Club podcast at America Magazine. My name is Kevin Spinelli, and I'm moderator of the book club. I'm here today with Matt Thomas, the author of the Catholic Book Club's September-October selection, We Are Not Ourselves. Matt's novel debuted at number 6 on the New York Times bestseller list and continues to sell well, occupying several top seller spots on Amazon.com. Matt Thomas is a New York City native who grew up in Queens. He is a graduate of the University of Chicago. He earned an MA from the Writing Seminar at Johns Hopkins and an MFA from UCal at Irvine. Most importantly, though, as any Regis grad would tell you, he is a graduate of Regis High School in Manhattan. Indeed, Regis High finds its way into Matt's novel. While writing We Are Not Ourselves, Matt taught for a number of years at Xavier High School, another prominent Jesuit high school in Manhattan. He is married and the father of two young children, twins. I'm quite certain that the experience of being a husband and father contributed to the composition and the content of this novel. Matt, welcome. Thank you for taking the time to be here.
Thank you very much for having me here. It's my honor.
Since the novel has debuted a few months ago at the end of August, beginning of September, tell us a little bit of your experience in the last several weeks.
Well, it's been a busy time, first of all. I've done quite a bit of promotion for the book. I did a tour pretty much across the country and into Canada. I had two stints that were separated by about a week where I was home with my wife and kids, and that was a wonderful week. But I've been to more cities than I would have expected to be able to go to on a tour. They certainly haven't stinted in their willingness to send me out on the road. Up into Calgary, Vancouver, and Toronto, and as far-flung places as Portland and Seattle and San Francisco. So it's been quite an odyssey.
Well, congratulations. I hope it continues. A little calmer, but...
Yeah, thank you.
...as full. The book is a long book. It's separated into 6 parts. Part 5 of the book is entitled, Desire is Full of Endless Distances. Could you tell me, is there any pedigree to that phrase, or is it your own?
No, it's a quote from a poem by Robert Haas, which I reference in the end of the book in the last section in Connell's epilogue. It struck me as being a very relevant phrase for these characters because of the nature of how far apart they are in their experiences, even in the middle of sharing them. In terms of proximity in the room, they can be in the same room but be in such a different place mentally and even spiritually at any given moment in the story. And also for Connell being as far away as he is physically, there's been an act of self-removal, but his mind has never really left his father. And there is a great desire to be there, even if it's not a desire that he feels on a conscious level all the time. It's a deep need for that family relationship that filters out of him in different ways, including finding a too soon kind of family type feeling for a girl who a classmate who he asked to marry him very young, very early. I think he's filling in the gaps in some ways of what he has not dealt with emotionally.
There seems to be throughout your novel a very full understanding of human experience, and sometimes novels make a claim, almost like propositional logic. They assert a claim. And the claim that I hear in your novel is that we are given our identity by our relationships, by the lack we feel, the need we have for others. And we're always... those who are the healthiest of human beings are always orientated outward toward others. And even in the most meaningful, close human relationships, there is a distance. There is a part of the other person that you love that is inaccessible to you, even though you love that person so deeply.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's the case with the characters here?
Well, first of all... thank you. That's an enormous compliment because I think that's a very sophisticated idea you're hinting at, and it's I certainly like to think that what you're saying is in the book. I was aware of writing toward a narrative of experiences in relationships, and the idea that relationship is the unit in which life is best measured, I think. And we can talk about what that relationship means. I know it's a different kind of relationship, many different types of relationships that I have in mind. But just the idea that we are, first of all, not only ourselves, that we are not islands unto ourselves, was very much on my mind, and why the title resonated for me beyond the ways that it speaks to these people being not at their best. I also think in terms of them needing each other to survive, needing each other to experience their greatest happiness on the planet. And we're getting into kind of difficult material in terms of a philosophical understanding. What is it? What is the nature of a self? What is the nature of a soul? Can you fully share an experience with someone else? What is the reality of the material plane? You know, is there a truth beyond the apparent reality before us that we are all accessing that we can't actually ultimately always share at a given moment because it's so kind of difficult to articulate? And you know, I tried to get into some of these questions. It's with some trepidation, obviously, because this is some of the most difficult material to write about. Questions of a more metaphysical nature. But the book provided an opportunity to write toward those because of the nature of the way Ed's mind is unraveling. It presented an immediate context for understanding the mind versus the body. And let's say the mind versus, or not, I shouldn't say versus, because that's sort of agonistic, but the mind and the soul, the mind and the spirit, how do these interrelate? That was always on my mind in the writing of this book.
Thank you. You know, I as Jesuits, we go to far too much school, so we sort of like to play around with these philosophical ideas, but the more school I sort of go to, I realize how much fuller stories give answers to these questions, mm-hmm. much fuller, richer answers. And that's why I so much enjoyed your novel. Toward the beginning of the novel, it's the story of Eileen Tumulty, Eileen Leary. She's an immigrant daughter, grows up in Queens, but there's something extraordinary about her. There's something extraordinary about her interior life. She has a number of realizations during her childhood that sort of redound and emerge later on in her adult life and maybe are transformed into sort of fuller realizations. I'd like to read just a bit from basically the beginning of the book. This is a realization she has, as you write, just around her fourth grade year at school. She's out with her father at a bar. She loves spending this time with her dad, and they come home a little late, and her mother had put out the dinner and had already gone to bed, or at least put herself in her room. And you write from Eileen's perspective. I'm just going to read a little bit. She was angry at her mother for adhering so rigidly to her rule, but her father didn't seem to share that anger. He ate slowly, silently, refilling her glass when he rose to fill his own, and ladling out more carrots for her from the pot on the stovetop. Then he put his coat on and went back out. Eileen went to the door of the bedroom, but didn't open it. She listened and heard nothing. She went to Mr. Keogh's door, but there was silence there too. She felt a sudden terror at the thought of having been abandoned. She wanted to bang on both doors and bring them out, but she knew enough not to go near her mother just then. To calm herself, she cleaned the stovetop and the counters, leaving no crumbs or smudges, no evidence that her mother had cooked in the first place. She tried to imagine what it would feel like to have always been alone. She decided that being alone to begin with would be easier than being left alone. Everything would be easier that way. Now, my question is, Eileen is, the word that I have to describe her character is fierce. She's a fierce worker. She fiercely pursues her dream. She's a fierce mother. She's a fierce She loves fiercely. She loves her son fiercely. She loves her husband. She cares for her husband fiercely. And I wonder if, in fact, Eileen is alone in her life because of that.
Mm. Well, I'm pausing because I'm thinking about what you're asking. It's a terrific question. I don't like to think of her being alone if she is alone. Well, one thing she's never separated from, I think, is her idea of a life. A kind of companion for her has always been a sort of platonically perfected notion of a life that she's reaching for. She's had a partner in that, in herself, which is to say a kind of supervening consciousness that tells her, this is not enough yet, there's more out there. This is not the life you want quite yet. And I really think that she derives maybe a measure of comfort from the presence of this other consciousness. And I don't want to say that there was a fugue state created in her necessarily when she was young, but there was a kind of an early eruption of a more mature way of thinking than maybe a kid her age would have had access to at that age. And I think she saw herself almost kind of phenomenologically at some point from the outside, looking at herself, wondering about herself, wondering about her life. But that, as I describe it, sounds fairly lonely. So I don't think she's alone. I think she cares very deeply about her family. I think she cares deeply about them in a way that isn't always articulated as feeling. She understands on a maybe a deeply unconscious level that she's the one that has to drive them toward this life that she wants. And for better or worse, it's a relatively common experience for the children of immigrants or the immigrants themselves to want to establish a firmer footing for whatever reasons a family has to leave an earlier existence in a previous country. There is, I think, a deeply felt need to establish a kind of equilibrium or calm here, and that calm can only come from not equilibrium, but a kind of ever-increasing state of affairs. And only, I think, when that's achieved can people start to relax. What I'm suggesting is that there is a kind of trauma that is implicit in the immigrant experience and the experience of the children of immigrants. So for Eileen, there's a loving care and concern for her husband and her kid that is kind of implicit in the way she lives her life. It's not to say that she doesn't have a kind of unitary vision, and in very many ways this is about her and a pursuit of a series of ideals. But let me just say I think it's interesting to me to think about her pursuing ideals, because Ed is really the explicit idealist in the story, and his idealism is one that we, I think, can find more palatable more immediately, which is to say he's interested in other people, he's interested in service, he's interested in doing the work for its own good, providing an education for people who couldn't otherwise afford it at a high level like the one he can provide. And I think we can get our minds around that as a kind of idealism, but there's a way to think of Eileen's life as a sort of idealism as well. It may not be one that we would politically identify with or even spiritually endorse, but there is for Eileen something like an idealistic pursuit at work here that I think has to be acknowledged. And I don't think it is entirely just a selfish pursuit either. I think she's interested in a kind of notion of a better life. In that vita activa, vita contemplativa split, Ed is the more of the vita contemplativa and she's living the more active life, but I don't think that it's devoid of a kind of philosophical mission.
I'm going to read another part toward the front, toward the beginning of your book, and talk a little bit more about Ed. This, again, is Eileen. She's in high school. She's, I think, again, in the midst of another realization about sort of adult life. And you write, she'd always understood that her father had been young once, but she'd never really considered what that meant. Now she saw him as a young man crossing a sea to start a life anew, a courageous man carrying a kernel of regret and heartache that he would feed with his silence. There was more in him than she'd grasped. She wanted to find a man who was like him, but who hadn't formed as hard an exterior. Someone fate had tested, but who had retained a little more innocence. Someone who could rise above the grievances of life had put before him. If her father had a weakness, that was it. There were other ways to be strong. She wasn't blind to them. She wanted a man whose trunk was thick, but whose bark was thin, who flowered beautifully, even if only for her. Talk a little bit about Edmund Leary. Talk about how perhaps this realization ultimately is reversed, in that she doesn't marry somebody who flowers beautifully for her, but she marries someone who I think in the end makes her flower beautifully.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me say a little bit about the two of them. First of all, she's raised in Woodside, Queens. Ed grows up in Brooklyn, in Carroll Gardens, what we call Carroll Gardens now, but I think that was called Red Hook at that time. Even that's an interesting border. Anyway, it's still a contested border. They grow up in somewhat similar circumstances insofar as Ed's father is a serious drinker and puts Ed through a kind of hell, forcing him to care for him as well and minister to his, you know, to his illness, picking him up at the bar on weekends and things like that. So they share a kind of history together, even if it's a history that was lived separately. Ed is a guy who has figured out a way to live fully in scholarship and in devotion to the craft of his science, and derives enormous gratification from his life in that regard. He is a man who resists the temptations of a more established life in the way that Eileen has looked for it. He resists promotions, and he resists a life in the private sector, because I think he has figured out that this way of living provides happiness for him. He ends up being very stubborn and resistant to change in some ways, because of how I think much he has figured out for himself. There may be a way that he closes off certain possibilities in advancement, even in his own field. And Eileen finds, obviously, some friction between him and her, insofar as she always wants him to pursue the dream that she's looking to pursue. But what happens to Ed eventually is that he starts showing signs of early onset Alzheimer's, and that forces Eileen to focus on him, care for him, and I think in that care she demonstrates her character, which is to be ultimately as self-sacrificing as Ed is in a very public way, but for her it's a much more private experience. It's not something that people are witnessing. The care that she provides is off stage, largely, although she does have a couple of very public encounters with people in Bronxville that sometimes embarrass her, but she finds, I think, in that crucible that of his illness, herself distilled to its essence, which is the goodness of her.
I'd like to think about sort of a very clear image. It's not, I guess, it's not really an image. It's a very concrete human item that can have meaning, but has tremendous meaning at the end of this novel. And I think it tells us a little bit about the relationship and the differences in personality between Eileen and her husband, Ed. It's a week before Eileen and Ed's wedding, and they go out for a nice dinner at Tavern on the Green. And Eileen's father has a connection to somebody who's a jewelry distributor. And she wants, as you write, to buy her husband a luxurious wedding gift. This always appeals to Eileen. There's something about glitz. Later on in the novel, she buys a fur for herself. Even though she feels a little out of place, she feels luxurious in it. She gives the watch, which has got a gold metal band, to her husband. And her husband looks at it and says, "Oh, that's nice, but I'm not going to wear it." and she's crushed. She's thinking to herself as Ed refuses the gift. Ed was still talking, but she didn't hear him. Quickly, dispassionately, she ran through the mechanics of how she would exit the restaurant. She wouldn't say a word. She would, of course, leave the watch on the table. She would go home and tell her parents that the wedding was off. She was disappointed that she wouldn't get to see her father in a top hat and tails. A little farther down the page, Ed says, "Maybe you could have them take off this gold band and put a leather one on it instead, if you don't want to take it back." This man, this is outside the quote, this man to whom she'd sworn her devotion was saying in lordly ignorance of how far from him she'd flown in her mind, how almost absurdly vulnerable he was to her at that moment. Ed says, "I'm a regular guy. I don't know how to wear a watch like this." It's just perfectly shows the differences, I think, in personalities. And it's especially meaningful because in the end, and this struck me, this sort of made me recall that scene, she decides not to have Ed's body donated to science. It has diminished beyond recognition. It's beat up. It's got scabs. He's, what, 57, 58 when he dies?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, around there. Mm-hmm.
And so she buries him, and you write, "He went intact into the earth, all the questions answered that would ever be answered, all the unasked ones forever unasked. Science had reached the end of its utility. All that remained was the body, and she wanted to give it tenderness. After all that trouble, she'd gone to put a leather band on the Le Couture." How do you say that?
Le Couture, yeah.
Le Couture watch. "Ed had never worn it. It had sat in its box for 32 years. She took it out of the case, under the velvet platform. In the bottom of the box, the gold band lay like a desiccated skin of a snake. She went to a jeweler and had it put back on. The restored watch was worth a good deal of money due to its pristine condition, its collectible nature, and the high price of gold. But that was immaterial now, as she buried him wearing it."
Those two scenes, for me, get at the heart of their relationship. And in many ways, my concerns in the book, beyond just writing the story of this family and these people. I was hinting at it earlier when I was talking about idealism. It's very easy to judge, I think, somebody for wanting more luxury, as you said earlier, and generally more in the way that we tend to think of more in America. For Eileen, there's a notion of abundance that she's always trying to live toward, and I think of Song of Solomon when I think of that watch and the desire to give him something luxurious. There's a sense in which this is the way that she has figured out how to articulate her feelings, her inner life, through the doing of things, the giving of gifts, the material world. And I think she lives in the material world in a way that allows her not to feel that it is a falling off from a higher ideal. She inhabits her body in a way that, while it's never, while she's never fully able to inhabit it, let's say, without some self-consciousness, there is a way that she has inhabited her body and tried to embrace the realm of the living and the realm of the material and the visible, and I think has a respect for it. The giving of that watch is the giving of not just a bauble that is essentially jewelry, but also something that will physically be on Ed's body, will be very close to his skin, will be near his hand and accessible to his eyes, and a kind of reminder of her. And she's not embarrassed by the trappings of a bodily existence in a way. I have her all throughout the book also interested in in a kind of metaphysical realm as well. I have her looking at the stars. I have her stopping and thinking about a scene and trying to remember it. So she's interested in also breaking away from the body and breaking into a realm of consciousness and cognition where she is alive in that way as well. But she is maybe busier than Ed is in some ways. She has a lot more going on in terms of responsibilities. She's a woman in her generation who, if she was going to live a professional life, was going to be asked still to run a household and keep the schedule and all the things that women, professional women in that generation, basically had to do. If they wanted to move forward in careers, they still had to run the whole ship in some ways. And Ed is, I think, absolved of some of that responsibility at home and is allowed, I think, to inhabit a more kind of metaphysical mental sphere. So I think the easy answer in those scenes is to look at Ed and say that he renounces the flesh and he renounces the material world. But another answer, I think, could be in that, and I feel affection for both of these characters in that scene. He could easily have just said, thanks, that's such a lovely gift, and just worn it, and renounced, I think, at that moment anyway, the need to take a philosophical position. But he does so, and while it's a respectable thing to do, to always have an ethos, have a goal in that way, I think there's a human failure on both sides there, if you want to see it.
I'd like to read part of the letter that Ed writes to his son. And by the way, I mean, this is beautiful. I hope to offer this in the midst of a retreat one of these days in the near future. Certainly the third week, thinking about suffering, the meaning of suffering. But I'd like to talk about, I'm going to read just a paragraph toward the end of it, and I'd like to talk about the relationship between father and son, which is a terribly powerful relationship throughout the book. And it's easy to see how Ed sort of fails Connell as a father simply because he has this illness that erases him as father, sort of turns the relationships up, it upends them. Ultimately. And it's easy to see Connell fail as a son. And I found myself getting angry at him throughout the novel. But then and again, when I think about myself and my own relationship, I've failed in the same way that Connell has failed. So it's easy to sort of, but I want you to just, I want to read this part of Ed's letter, and I want to ask you just to describe the relationship between Ed in a son, and maybe what he's given his son. Ed writes, "When I am gone, I want you to hear my voice in your head. Hear it when you most need to, when you feel most helpless, hopeless, when you feel most alone, when life seems too cruel and there seems too little love in it, when you feel you have failed, when you don't know what the point is, when you cannot go on. I want you to draw strength from me then. I want you to remember how much I cherished you, how I lived for you. When the world seems full of giants who dwarf you, when it feels like a struggle just to keep your head up, I want you to remember there is more to live for than mere achievement. It is worth something to be a good man. It cannot be worth nothing to do the right thing."
Ed has given Connell an example of a father who works hard, is devoted to his job, is not necessarily contained entirely within that sphere. And it was important to me to write toward a character like this because of the idea I think the culture presents all the time of the virtue in professional life, in advancement, and the reasonability of comparisons between oneself and other people along a spectrum of success or failure in very literal, empirical ways. And I've always found this to be stultifying because it doesn't really address anything like the spiritual life. Setting even religion aside in any way, in a very basic way, just a notion of a belief in the value of a person beyond what that person can contribute materially, just the idea of the importance of the existence of this person, is something that our culture doesn't really make much hay of. And for Ed, I think he sees, when he writes this letter, he sees that his son is going to be facing a lot of questions without him. Ed is writing this in maybe the last flowering of his consciousness, not that day particularly, but in that period of time. And is aware, because he's an intelligent person, of how complicated the emotional landscape will be for Connell, and how much anger he might feel on a subterranean level, let's say. And maybe Connell will be aware of feeling angry at Ed for failing him by dying, basically, and putting Connell in a sort of Oedipal position where he has now successfully kind of killed the father, if you think of that Oedipal impulse as being one that is a real one in any way. Eliminate the father and take his place beside the mother. The Connell has been given that Freudian sort of ideal outcome here, if you want to look at it like that, except it's a disaster for that to happen, because now the boy will have a really complicated relationship to responsibility, maturity, and all of these things. I think Ed writing that letter was an attempt to get him to think differently than he knows maybe the culture will encourage him to think later in his absence, to plant a seed that says, you're worth something, you're beautiful because you're alive. And there is no way of evaluating you that's more important than the one that says that you are, a creation, a creature, a living thing, and that's more important than whether you succeed or fail. And the irony there is that that allows Connell to bury a lot of the bad feelings he has, and ultimately, in this case, to go on and finish his college degree and become a teacher and a professional. And it is, I think, the kind of forgiveness of one's limited humanity that we all need, in a sense, to be able to achieve anything great, which is to say, you don't actually need to do that to be loved. You're loved anyway. And embrace the value that there is in you, and feel the goodness of that feeling, and that will allow you to embrace the world. So I think Ed was trying to bridge something like a gap between where Connell would be as he imagined where he'd be and where he'd hope he would get, which would be a place of loving himself, respecting himself, and being able to turn outward into the world and do some good.
I think sometimes that's the hardest thing for any human being to sort of believe, is that they are loved. I think it's the hardest thing for a Christian to believe that God loves unconditionally. Perhaps the most successful, the healthiest human beings are those who can sort of grasp that in a full way. I'd like to, there's a lot of suffering in this book. It is a hopeful book. It's a wonderful story, but there is a lot of suffering as well. And perhaps, I've read enough, maybe. Maybe could you read this part? We won't end here, but I'd like you to sort of reflect a bit about suffering and how suffering might intensify the reality that we are, in fact, we are not ourselves, fact. And I'm on page 382, 383. If you could read some for us. He told her he went to church between masses.
He told her he went to church between masses when the doors were left open, and sat in the back. It's quiet, he said. Calm. She thought about all the tangled noise in his brain. What did it sound like in there? She imagined it to be like the static on a radio, tuned between stations. What do you think about? She asked. You, he said. Connell, I don't want things to be hard for you when I'm gone, and I don't want him to get this. I'd do anything to avoid that. The thought of Ed alone in that big church oppressed her. If I write a prayer for you, will you use it? Sure, he said. You might have been telling the truth. Dear God, she wrote, I will offer this up to you without complaint, but please protect all I know and love. She copied it out neatly onto an index card that she folded and put in his wallet. She never heard Ed ask, why me? But she couldn't help asking it for him. Why Ed? Why now? Why so young? There was the obvious answer. It was random, senseless, genetic, environmental, but she didn't like that one. She also knew she couldn't sign on to any system that said it had all happened for a reason. So she took a third path, the pragmatic one. It hadn't happened for a reason, but they would find something to glean from it anyway. There didn't have to be a divine plan for there to be meaning in life. People's lives will be better because of his illness, she told herself. They'll appreciate life more. He'll remind them that their lives are better than they think. It was as good a story as any, and it had the virtue of often seeming plausible, though never when she lay awake at night. When the public life faded away, and other people vanished, and she was left staring at the back of her hand and thinking, all of this is an illusion, even the consolations. She was taken back to her bed when she was a child, when she would lie awake listening to her parents in the living room, rehearsing their fixed roles after her father had returned from the bar, and she thought, no time has passed since then. I'm there right now. She remembered examining her hand then as well, and the only thing to differentiate this moment from any of 100 in the past, the only thing that reassured her that the loop of her life wasn't about to start over again, was the crenellated landscape of wrinkles around her knuckles, which she ran her fingers over, feeling their washboard knobbiness.
It's suffering is real. The back of our hand is very real. The sort of age that someone, it's apparent on their hands. Do Eileen and Ed show us that there is some sort of meaning in human suffering?
I hope so. I was raised on Dostoevsky, so I've always been led to believe there is redemption in suffering, redemption through suffering, not in suffering. Those are very different prepositions. I hope that they provide a feeling of the possibility that there is some meaning in the suffering, if only in the sense that these lives have been observed by this book, and they were lived off to the sideline of history in a way that is, quote, unimportant in the culture. There is no historical record of these lives or lives like them. And so the word redemption becomes a kind of a way of speaking about, you know, the value of a life in general. There is so much suffering in life. There's so much pain. Our bodies are time machines. We see evidence of ruin every day when we look at them. Is it all for naught in the absence of a belief in God, which of course provides the greatest balm in the world and the most beautiful reassurance? If one can access a faith, there's so much potential for so much suffering to be alleviated by the knowledge of redemption in the afterlife, or even just in the doing of good works, and how that can actually affect one's relationship to one's God. But if you set that aside, and the possibility of a spiritual and religious life aside, is there redemption possible through suffering? I think there is, because I think it's a fact of reality for people's lives in general that there is suffering. And the knowledge that other people are less alone when they understand the communion that there is in the suffering of existence. The redemption, I think, comes in the form of a kind of communal meal, which is to say we understand and acknowledge each other's difficulties on the planet, and in that conversation can get past them somewhat. We can alleviate each other's pain just by being near each other. And if we exist in relationships to each other, we can put aside, for the time we are together, the things that disturb us, the things that trouble our spirits. So the book, I think, is making an argument for the way relationships are ultimately the light cast against the darkness. Because in that moment, Eileen, when she's perfectly alone, she has the hum of her thoughts. And the best thing for her at that moment would be an embrace, but there's nobody there. I also think that, you know, in a slightly more philosophical way, there is a kind of redemption that comes from just the concentration on something other than oneself. And if there's a need for someone to focus on oneself, all the time because of the immediate presence of pain. The only way, I think, to make something good out of that is to try to offer it up in some way, to try to say that this is something I will endure, and I will try to do it, as Eileen says, gracefully and with dignity. If there can be a way to experience suffering and not turn it into self-pity, that there's love for the self and for the suffering that one endures, obviously, and respect for the fact that this is happening. But the idea is that I will try to deal with this anyway and do my best to live in relationship anyway. There can be a triumph over the circumstances of life.
Thank you. I like how you say that. You know, when one is suffering or when one is in pain, it's difficult to get beyond that self-focus of the experience, the consciousness of that pain or suffering. And there's tremendous meaning if one, and perhaps maybe it's transformative, if one can get beyond that and extend oneself to others in care or even in the reception of care, which is also very hard for us to do. Especially for men, to accept care. I'd like to conclude with baseball.
Okay, that's a great way to conclude anything.
Toward the end of the book, Eileen attends a baseball game, the Mets. She finds some sort of, I don't know, it's cliche to say closure, but some sort of wonder at watching a game. She sort of senses herself becoming more and more involved in it and desiring the Mets to win, and she gets her win. Just talk about that scene. Talk about it. Baseball. You mentioned Babe Ruth's tomb. It's close to Ed's grave. Why is baseball important for us, for this novel, for that moment in Eileen's life?
How long do we have? Well, just I want to speak at a number of levels here, so okay. Maybe give me a few minutes.
Sure,
baseball provides a backdrop for so much of the internal life. It's a sport that people who aren't in love with it think of as being languorous, and I think part of that languor is the lack of understanding of the intricacies of the way the game comes alive in small ways at small moments throughout what appears to be a kind of more languorous pace. And it's an argument for, I think, getting inside anything and seeing it from the inside. Baseball, I think, is a great metaphor for perspective in life, point of view. You might just be a person who likes much more active sports, and in that case, maybe baseball wouldn't be your sport. Maybe soccer is your sport, and that's a separate question. But if you can accept the premise that there's a way of knowing something from the inside rather than the outside, baseball is a great metaphor for that, because if you understand the mechanics of each little exchange, everything bursts into greater life and is cast into a greater relief. And there's so much more drama in any individual moment. I think that's a great metaphor for writing a novel, let's say, because these things that appear from a distance to be unimportant, uninflected, are actually inflected greatly and charged with a great significance in individual lives. Baseball in America, I think, was a way for immigrant groups to immediately access a kind of relationship to the existing order. It was a communal language. It was a way for people to share conversation that I think is still the case. It's a way for academic-minded men to interact with guys who earn a living with their hands and don't have the time to sit around and do a lot of thinking. It's a way for men in general to access a kind of intergenerational transference. If they had a father who played ball before them or had a catch with them, there's a kind of retention through time of a cultural connection to the sport. And it's a way for men and women to interact across the divide of a sport, because of just the nature of baseball being a kind of a public event. When you attend a game, there's so much more going on than what's happening on the field, and what's happening in the stands is its own drama. it's a way for fathers and daughters to relate through the passion of fandom, and daughters to retain a relationship to their fathers and to their mothers in some cases. So I think it's a way for families to come together. And in the end, though, it's a sport in which one is pitted against oneself in some ways. The fact of failure so often on both sides of the rubber, pitching and hitting. Baseball's a game dominated by failure. And yet there's always a winner and a loser, ostensibly, at the end of each contest. For Eileen, in particular, in this book, baseball was something that made her feel like an outsider, because her son and her husband enjoyed such a close bond over it. And I think she feels a kind of resentment of it that she doesn't entirely understand. She's very happy when the Mets are out of town in 1986, when they're away in Boston.
Please don't mention that series.
I won't. We won't talk about it. I wrote about the game in which the Mets lost. She's happy when they're out of town because this mania of this playoff run is not at the forefront for those couple of days. So I think there's a kind of unconscious frustration that she feels and resentment of the game. And when Ed is gone, everything about it that had kept her at bay now becomes available to her in a way, because it's a way that she's able to access her relationship to him just by sitting in the stands and leaving a seat open for him. The thing that had seemed to compete for her affections is now actually there for her and available to her as an outlet. And when she opens her heart to this game, the possibility of this game, she finds a relatively quick way to care about this individual outcome. So I think that the sport of baseball has always presented writers with tremendous opportunities for finding other significance and metaphorical power. But I tried to write around it in a way that it wasn't subsumed just by metaphor, that for her it was, at the end of this, she just cared about the game. She cared about the outcome. And what I wanted for her always was just to be able to sit still and just inhabit a moment and care about that moment. And she does that in that game. And she cares very deeply about what happens for no really good reason, just because she wants to see them win. And I see that as a victory for her. And it leads right into that scene where she has dinner with the Indian family that has bought her house, where for once she's able to just sit still and enjoy a meal and experience being alive on the planet and being embraced by these people and not evaluating anything anymore and just experiencing the delicious meal they're giving her.
Matt, thanks so much for our conversation. Thank you for illuminating us, sort of breaking open the novel for us. Thank you for a beautiful book. I wish you luck in the future.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.